This is G. Barnes, and this session is a creative writing session called Writing from the Inside Out. Now, I kind of forewarned you yesterday, kind of gave you a little fair warning, that one thing that I wanted to kind of consider for this morning would be to see if anybody had gotten to the point in fixing up that we could start out today by reading some of the things that you've generated in the last couple of days, or, you know, before, or if you've done any dabbling with something that you started before but are farther along with it now or whatever. And I, you know, I have to say in my defense, I haven't really put you on the spot much. So, and you have had, you know, a half a day here now since yesterday afternoon to this morning to think about it and think whether or not you'd be willing or whatever. So it's no pressure. But I think that's kind of a good way to start a closing class, which I wish this weren't, but it is. So does anybody have something that that they wouldn't? Oh, yeah, here's the one that was coming up that, okay. Now what we should do is, again, zing around the room, and you're not getting that done by the time you are leaving. I'm sorry.
I read it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for coming to these sessions.
Bye.
Drop us a card. Let us know how your munchkins are doing. Junior high teaching is right on the front lines. Maybe we should zing around the room and say who we are by first name, at least, so that we'll all have at least that much information. And then we can begin. So, go.
My name is Sherry Landry.
Megan.
Pete Kilmer.
Joanne Kilmer.
Diane Shiner.
Dal Larson.
Dal, is it?
Udell.
Oh, Udell. Yeah. Great. I'm G. Barnes. There goes the bell onto the tape. Must mean time to start as the bus pulls out. Now, I'm doing this just a cold reading here. I appreciate your asking us to hear this and stuff. Might be good. They sound like a little more energetic group next door there. I think that's Saturday morning aerobics or something. Light impact poetic aerobics. This is the one that we heard a little snippet of on the first day, and this has been revised and rehashed and added to and moved around and so on. It's called The Neighborhood Grocery Store Years Remembered. Do you want to say anything about this, by the way, before we start?
Well, it's my memories of growing up in Amanda grocery store. Her store was here, her house was here, and we had a corridor connecting the two, so I literally lived in a grocery store as I was growing up.
Mm. Kind of hard to run out of things in a situation like that. I'm going to go up to the store and get some eggs. Okay, The Neighborhood Grocery Store Years Remembered. White pull-out drawer with names on receipt books. Adelsman, Darby, Glend, Nelson, Rockwood, Solomson. Customer names with memories alphabetized in the drawer. Cash register, green and black, that had two different sounds when you used it. A clicking sound from the round button keys that looked like they'd come from Grandma Sharp's button jar, and the silver lever that clashed when you pulled it hard. Darlene, with the number two pencil behind her left ear, auto, dusting with a gray feathered brush with a reddish brown handle chipped and worn from the imprint his aging fingers made. Jack, tall and lean in a stained muscle shirt, stacking number three coffee cans in basement rows. The snowboy truck, every Monday, backed into the driveway. Boxes of Washington apples, grapefruit, oranges, lettuce and endive for Dr. Ray. All lifted carefully into coolers that hummed loudly on those hot summer days. Christmas ribbon candy being bagged in 1 pound baggies with remnants of shavings left in the bottom of the box. Angel candy, sweet and foamy, covered lightly with a bittersweet chocolate glaze. The odd pieces were mine to eat. I've wished for that same taste every Christmas since. Fresh fish arriving from Seattle, a novelty, twice a year in Fergus Falls. Stored on the garage floor, stamped in red, special freight. I had gone to the train depot with Dad to pick up the order. Crated in wooden slats, I think it is, beady lobster eyes looked up at me, crab pincers flinched, salmon skin shone silvery while I held onto Dad's pants leg. A wooden herring bucket on the main counter, the wooden lid ajar. When I raised the lid, little seedy things floated atop brine, a disgusting liquid that smelled worse than strong vinegar. Emptied gunji sacks of peanuts piled high for display, with a gray plastic mouse hidden in them, my dad's sense of humor. Round casing of blue cheese stored inside a plastic clear dome. Saturdays, a father and his son drove in from Gutenberg Heights and bought 3/4 pound to eat on morning toast. The nasty stench early in the morning made me gag. I vowed when watching Dad disinfect the knife, never to eat that stuff. I never have. Vinegar barrel atop the back porch stoop next to dozens of clear, sterilized gallon jars. A wooden spout filled the jars to the rim, and sometimes if you were too slow to overflowing. Vinegar traveling like streams of urine down the blacktop driveway. We'd wait today for the dill man to come in from the country. It was canning time. Winter, entrance shed erected to dampen the bitter cold. Inside the shed, customers stomped snow off their boots, noticing winter's necessities. Shovels, an ice pick, sidewalk salt, 25 pounds of bird seed, jumper cables. The neighborhood grocery, ready for winter. Summer, ripened fruit, Bing cherries delivered Monday off the snowboy truck, now too ripe for sale. Mom individually picked them out for me, bagged to overflowing in brown waxed lunch bags that stained the sides with blood. Dark cherries, plump, sweet, and juicy. Neighborhood kids would gather on the front step and ask why I never chose candy. Why instead spoiled cherries that stained? Your dad would let you pick any candy you wanted. But I clutched even more tightly my bag of juicy gems, my bag of beans. There's a lot of stuff in here. A lot of stuff in here. I'm sorry that I realized only after I'd mumbled along after something that I botched it in a couple of spots.
Thanks for reading.
My apologies for prowsing around that way.
Tell us what you said something yesterday about what you want to do with that.
I'm going to give it to my parents. I don't know in what form. But it's pretty long.
Yeah, poems given to people, it's remarkable how much they treasure them, even if we really don't. And especially if there's a presentation about it, so that it's a booklet or in frame or, something. I wouldn't recommend maybe wood burning it on the front of the house or anything with a router, but it is now. There was some additional stuff in there from what we heard the other day, obviously. Mm-hmm. And then I'll just ask the group, how do you feel about the poem now, including how you felt about it the other day? Do you feel we're going in a direction that was comprehensible and had a good flow and so on? Or what remarks have you? I think it's okay to, tell a person in general ways what you think.
So any comments at all?
I think it's okay to, you would not mind the comments, because sometimes a group like this who's interested in writing can.
I like the poem a lot. I mean, it's very evident that it's got a lot of beautiful stuff in it. It makes me, think about my childhood. It didn't have very many good moments, and I think, what could I pull off, would feel good, and then I think, you know, but I'd have to press myself, but the things are there, you know. And I also think I repressed a lot of things as a child, so it's very hard to remember because I didn't want to remember anything. And which is probably really a good thing to do, you know. And there are other things, like fleeting moments, like when I went to Dittowig's grocery store. And it makes me think of Dittowig's, you know, this wonderful little grocery store in Deposit, New York, right down the hill from Aquata Lake, where we'd sometimes go in the summer. So it's like, yeah, now I can smell the air. I mean, so you helped me get into something that was a good memory. Yeah, thank you. It's really lovely. I'm very, very lovely.
I think a difference that I noticed, and maybe it was there the first time, and I just didn't hear it all. I don't know if what we did yesterday about the senses added the sounds to the poem. I don't remember when you first read it. You know, I remember visual images, but I really felt the poem was really enhanced by the humming and the clicking and the sounds that you put into it. I really.
And I purposely had to, I mean, that yesterday helped me a lot, and I got up really early this morning and kind of, because I realized that it's a lot of visual imagery, but not as much auditory.
Yeah, well, in both the auditory and smell, you know, there was an awful lot to smell in the poem. And it gave me an appreciation for the value of the effort of those additions. I have a really hard time editing and changing and whatever, and I mean, I could see that it built a better, fuller image, and I really like it a whole lot. And also, you gave me a gift because I grew up in a furniture store. And as I was hearing you, it was like, oh God, yes, yes, yes. So I'm going to have to write about
that. See, we do have material, you know. That's it's something that I stress just all the time. Mm-hmm. Think, oh, well, me, I just grew up in a furniture store, until we hear somebody write a great grocery store poem, and you think, I grew up in a furniture store, for goodness sakes, you know. And it's true. That's and another thing that I want to quickly slip in is that our memories are made out of, I think, I mean, this seems to be true as I talk to people, I don't think it's just me, but it seems that our memories are actually made up of the sensory information itself. Mm-hmm. Not so much what we thought of it, you know, especially if we're going back for very young memories. We don't tend to sort of editorialize and rhapsodize and make it pretty, you know, as kids. We just experience it. And so to haul that experience forward, that's real crucial stuff to, that's the actual materials, the raw materials from which a poem can get made. And if it's done right, then the reader has all kinds of thoughts about it and designs upon it, you know, remarks to make about it and experiences they pull through it. So. A poem really, for me, this is just me talking, but a poem for me, or any piece of expressive, you know, personal writing, is one that we work very hard to go back and get the raw materials and put those out in an arranged way, and then we rely on the fact that somebody else is going to read that and make their interpretation. For example, it's often tempting to us to use some of the readers, the words that the readers are entitled to be using. We sometimes want to put those into the poem ourselves. So we'll say, it was a beautiful sunset. You know, well, that's okay, but it's kind of taking a short route, because if we describe the sunset correctly, we say, I'm thinking of Teak's lightning storm poem. You know, you put the colors in there and the sounds in there and all that stuff in there, the person says, that was a scary and amazing and long-term and never-ending lightning storm, you know. And the same thing can be true of the sunset. You put the right colors and the fashion, the actual materials, and then the reader says, "Whoa, that must have been beautiful," you know. So we don't want to do the reader's work. We want to do our work. Our work is different. Our work is descriptive, listing, going back to the root elements, putting in the actual raw materials. Anybody else have something they want to read, or?
Yeah, I do.
Do you? Good.
This is evolving. I'm having fun with this. You're waking me up a lot. These couple of classes already, and I'm really excited about it. I remember the snapping and crackling of the bark-toned toast and the fragile, juicy bacon oozing into the clinging, rich peanut butter. The mingling of syrupy fats gliding around my tongue and palate. in the pioneering, or let's see, no, shoot, something. And the discoveries in my pioneering taste bud, take a look at that one. Just seeing Michael again after all these years, and I remember our childhood in the damp grass and warm sun, and deeply being deeply involved with the world premiere of peanut butter and bacon sandwiches on that vacation day at the Quagga Lake picnic.
Oh,
that's cool.
Yes,
you want a bacon and peanut butter sandwich?
No.
Reminds me of Elvis. I want a peanut butter banana sandwich. Yeah.
I'll tell you, they were amazing, and I haven't had one in 30 years.
Yeah.
Because of the being so
fat-filled.
Yeah. All the really good stuff we can.
I'll be able to carry that memory with me, and I don't have to have the sandwich.
Yeah, no. And we can codify, that's an important point that you've made, is that by making something with it, you know, putting the words on the paper in this case, or whatever other, you know, let me use an analogy here from sports again. In sports, in gymnasium classes now, what do you call them, PE, now they're following a curriculum that typically in most enlightened areas that talk about lifelong sports. And that during your growing up and so on, before you get out of high school or whatever, you should have had a chance to try on experiences with lots of different sports to see which one or ones, usually there's more than one, are kind of your lifelong sports, something that you could enjoy and get better at and improve and continue lifelong. And it starts out with stuff like, are you a team sport personality? Are you an individual sport personality? You know, do you like to bike, swim, run, that kind of stuff? Or do you like to kick soccer balls and play volleyball and, you know, that kind of stuff? Do you like to be outdoors? Do you like to be into, you know, all that kind of stuff? Well, I would say that I think the same thing is true of arts, that we all ought to have try-on experiences with a plethora of different arts so that we can find ourselves locating one or two or three or four lifelong arts, those arts that we can go ahead and continue to practice. Why? Well, not to be in galleries and not to make books and not to, you know, but for the sheer enjoyment of it. I mean, as we, you know, maybe when we were in school or something, we played for the team or we, you know, whatever, and that's, you know, there was the glory of that and the camaraderie and all the things that go with that. But as we go along in life, we do it just for the joy of it, just for the pleasure, just for the release. And that's, those same words can be attached to arts. We do it for the joy of it, for the pleasure of it, for the release, for the understanding that it brings us. And, you know, it's possible that writing is a lifelong art for many of us. It's possible that photography is another one. It's possible that playing the saxophone really loud is one. You know, it's whatever. Again, I think we can see, well, do we like to work with a group of people? Well, do we want to go into theater, dance, choreography, orchestras, and so on? Do we like to work alone? You know, it's one of the real things when younger people come to me and say, well, you know, do you think I can be a writer? I have to say, do you like to spend 4 or 5 hours alone? You know, do you mind that? Does it drive you crackers? Well, then you probably shouldn't take up painting or writing or, you know, as something that you want to pursue seriously, as a lifelong pursuit. Do you like filling up waste baskets with, you know, crumpled paper? Do you like taking out the trash a lot? You know, if so, you might like to be a writer. Any other readings from the group?
Well, I can read a couple.
Oh, shoot at it, yeah.
Well, this is certainly, I've just done like, you know, free flow writing, but this is the first I've tried to condense it into, you know, this little piece of paper here.
Was that helpful or hurtful? I don't know.
Well, it was tremendously helpful. I don't know what you told me after you hear it. So, and also I kind of cheated. We're supposed to do a memory, yeah. And I'm going, I don't know, my mind was not clear yesterday. So I kind of did a composite thing.
Uh-huh. See, there really aren't any rules in this.
That's it. I call it pedaling. My flying bike, breezing my skin, blowing my hair. Excited chirp songs of birds and trees. The pebbly path bouncing, joggling. Dust smells. Trees leaning in, shading my hot skin.
Wow. Can you read that again?
Sure. My flying bike, breezing my skin, blowing my hair. Excited chirp songs of birds in trees. The pebbly path, bouncing, joggling. Dust smells. Trees leaning in, shading my hot skin.
Wow. Mm. That's a common experience lifted out of commonality, I think, yeah. You know, expressed in your way. You know? Mm-hmm. I think many of us could relate to that, but...
The tree's leaning in.
Yeah. Well, thanks for reading that for us. That brought back a lot for me.
Yeah. So. I do have one more.
Oh, do it. Keep going.
Teek might not appreciate this one. I read it from last night.
Yeah.
He groaned.
I'm going to read it in front of everybody.
It's titled Teek. You're right.
This was inspired. I journal in the mornings, and last week when all the fire alarms were
going. Oh, yeah.
I was fire alarmed from bed this morning. My husband slept, snored. Firefighters dressed in yellow and black, ready. We wait. Burnt toast.
Yeah. That's the cause that day.
Oh my gosh, yes. I like the feeling, when you asked her to read the first one again, for me, it was because I didn't expect it to stop right then, so I wasn't really listening for the first part.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that abruptness. Mm. It just gets,
Yeah, it just hauls you up short.
Yeah.
Done. Yeah. How is that punctuated? Does it have a colon before the words burnt toast?
Dot, dot, dot.
Okay. Any others? Oh, thanks. I was afraid you were going to skip out on this, so.
No. This memory thing, every time I try to write about a memory, the same one comes up. And I cannot come up with, I haven't been able to come up with the right organization of the words and get through the first line, and it's very odd because I can write about a million other things.
Mm-hmm. That's a dither because there are several things that are maybes on this. Maybe it's not time for that one yet.
Yeah.
Maybe it really is time and you need to face up to the music and do it. Maybe you need to trust that nobody really is going to see it, although I have a sneaky suspicion, I have this fear in the pit of me that everything I ever write down, somebody's going to read sometime.
Right.
Yeah.
I know.
I see myself in a few years lighting this stuff in, the big pile of stuff and putting it in the grate one by one. But, at this juncture where we are now with the writing, it's for you. You're writing for you. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where all the art that we really like a lot starts and stays with for a long time through its making. The word poet, if you go back far enough, means maker. That's all we are. We're just people making stuff, And so, for example, I don't imagine Picasso in his successful years in his Spanish castle painting this thing thinking, this is going to look great over somebody's sofa, Wait till I get this puppy out, to my agent. I think, it's memory, it's, opinion about stuff, it's response to the world, all that kind of stuff, to his daughter in some cases, all this stuff, and it's just for him, And then eventually, I know many, many painters who will not turn loose of stuff. You go through their studio. It's like, could I buy that? Well, I don't know. Let me think about it. Let's look at some others. You kind of go around through the whole lot of them, and finally they say, I really don't want to sell any of this stuff right now. And then maybe if you come back in 6 months, they say, I can live without that now. And so I think that's how it is with us if we're trying to be earnest about it. Is that we do it for ourselves, and we have a sense that I think grows as we continue to be practitioners of how to move into a memory or how to move into difficult, dark territory, which all of us have, So I would encourage you to to stick with it, but only for you. And see what begins to come from there later. I think that's a great way to start such a session, is by kind of hearing what people are doing, so on, and what people have done through our times together. I'll be doing some sessions again next week, too, and I wish that the schedule had allowed me to do it in the last couple of weeks, especially so you two could have been in and kind of been the people to carry through with us and stuff, but it won't be this week and next week, and so that's the way the Lord designed the time. They haven't decided yet. They just kind of tell me. they tell me this way. Can you fill in here? Can you take that slot? I'm never going to agree to try to do Creekside in the afternoon again. You know, I think if I'm going to do Creekside, I want in the morning. Thank you. It's an oven in there. But there's one other thing that I wanted to mention to you to do with yours. This is going to be a really handsome gift. And a rule of poets, never give away the only copy of anything.
Right.
Ever. Okay? Not even for a night. Okay? Which reminds me, have all the books come back in? I don't know. I'll look on the list before we go. But I know a poet who scribbled a poem on a cocktail napkin in an airplane. And it was a free poem. You know, it was a short, free poem. And the cabin attendant came by and realized that it was a poem and said, "Oh, that's really nifty. Can I see that?" Sure. Took it back and lost it. So never let a poem, the only copy of a poem, because you might want to, that might grow it, you know, into something that was really sort of a watermark, you know, time for you. Now, I want to stress that we don't always have to write poetry, and that poetry serves us in other kinds of writing. Right now, there's been a wonderful resurgence in the last, I suppose by now it's about 8 or 10 years, in the personal reflective essay. It fell to, you know, disuse. Nobody was printing them. Nobody was seeming to write them. Nobody wanted to read them. You think back, though, to Emerson, Thoreau, etc., others, you know, it was a very fertile ground. And now I feel that it is again. You know, people are writing that stuff again. And you think, you know, of people like Wendell Berry, you think of people like Annie Dillard, you think of people like John McPhee, who are writing really rich essay material now. It's based on the life of memory, it's based on the life of the mind, it's based on stuff that they see when they're driving down the road, it's based on stuff that they overhear in conversation, it's based on stuff that they catch on the front page of the newspaper. It's responsive. It's, you know, it's an interchange between themselves and the outside world. Those were just off the top of the head, but I remember saying Wendell Berry. He's an older fella and lives in Kentucky, I think, Tennessee. And he writes poetry, essays, sermons, you name it, and fiction. And so on, and he has a self-sustainable farm. He plows with oxen. There aren't machines except the typewriter, I don't think, on the farm. And I've met him, and he's a delightful person. But he writes just some really, really, really strong personal essay, kind of, you know, creative nonfiction material. Annie Dillard, of course, is so fertile in that way. Who else did I say? John McPhee. He has a very highly stylized. He's the only writer that I know who actually does it like they had us do it in the eighth grade when we were learning how to write term papers, where he writes out these ideas on note cards, has a big bulletin over the desk, and he puts them in an order, and then he shifts them a little bit, and then he writes from that, you know, which is how they told us to do it. And I don't know anybody else who really does it like an eighth grade English teacher thinks we are supposed to do it, but. But he does, and it's wonderful. But there's a book called Oranges. You'll learn more about oranges. I mean, that's what it's about. And there are books that have to do with sports figures. There's one that has to do with Bill Bradley called A Sense of Where You Are. They're just really, really handsomely done pieces. So that's a fertile ground, too, and one that's not divorced from the writing of poetry. We use the same, richness of the sensory world and our impressions that are sensory and so on, Now, it's said that about 90% of the information that we get is visual, but it doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be. It's just that that's kind of how we are in this culture now. And we can improve our abilities. we can improve our abilities to pick up stuff that's audio or that's the fragrances of things and so on. And you might try it sometime for a spell. I've done all kinds of little experiments like these. And one way is when we go into a room, often we'll, even without thinking, we'll kind of glance around and just kind of get the layout of the room, what's there, how many chairs, where are the people, and so on. And rather than go into a room and see what you smell, you know, and just make that sort of a little habit that you do. Mm-hmm. You know, what does it smell like in the elevator? What does it smell like in this room? What does it smell like, you know, just inside this front person's front door where you're trying to hand them back the thing that fell off their car 2 blocks back? You know, what's it smell like in the car, and so on. And I've found that you can kind of, I've been able to sort of train myself to develop more of a sense of smell and be readier to accept that information. Taste of things, obviously, and we work in a tactile world more than we know. Anytime you find stuff in your writing that says hot, cold, hard, soft, squidgy, liquid, slippery, you know, it's there, but we sometimes don't really give it the same lofty impression as something that we've seen. You know, but it's very important to us. It's very urgent to us. If you are in a too hot room like we were yesterday, you just know it, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's got to be a part of the writing. I mean, we wouldn't be fair to that room or our experience in it together if we didn't write, you know, pretty close off the bat that it was too hot, you know. Mm-hmm. And it makes you kind of fuzzy thinking and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But scratchy sweaters, I mean, little kids operate in this world more, you know. There was one kid that wrote this great poem about the fear of putting on a sweater that you pull over your head. This is about a six-year-old kid. And it's like, you can see, and then you can't see, you know, and then you can see, you know. And it also had something about, you know, just the scratchiness of it. And it's the whole, you know, 12 seconds or whatever it took, 3 seconds maybe, was really unpleasant and fearful for this kid. Wanted button-up sweaters, you know, so you didn't have to go through that. So those are the... And so then what are we saying there? I think I mentioned only two of the three things that I juggled yesterday. I said that I feel that I'm continually juggling writing and reading, and then the other one is experiencing. And by that, I mean experiencing as deeply as I can. And experiencing as personally as I can. If I'm going to catch sight of a sunrise, I would like it to be mine, please. Mm. You know, that's what I mean by personally. We have seen depictions in paintings of sunrises, in films, we've read them in novels, so on and so on. Well, you know, I'm Native American, I'm Choctaw and Cherokee. And in many cultures, and especially in the Southwest, which I'm not, it's thought that if you're not up to see the sunrise, then you don't deserve to have the day. And so that's a Hogan faces east, and you go out and face the sun and wait for it to come. You know, and you're standing there ready to greet it. You wouldn't want the sun to come up and have nobody to greet it. And so, if I'm going to have the sound of a waterfall, if I'm going to have, you know, the whatever, I would like it to be mine. And how do I do that? Well, to experience deeply and richly and personally, I think that art itself contributes toward that. You know, that the making of art helps us find ways that we want to be expressive and interchange with that material in that moment that are ours and that are authentic. That's what I want to say, that are authentic. It's too easy to let somebody else's, you know, somebody else's impression stated in a movie or in a poem or something, you know, that those begin to pile up on cliche after cliche, and let that be our writing, and let that be our experience, and so on. So I'm talking about that way in which the juggling keeps going, and that in the experiencing, the ball that says experiencing, that the other two feed that the reading and the writing feed that and make that a richer, more personal time. Now, I want to allow time for some questions before we go on into the next... I don't want to put it that way because that makes it sound like I really don't want to hear questions. I want to hear questions or remarks if you have them now, but that doesn't mean the class is closing. What I'm saying is I don't want to leave until the end because I might cheat you out of them. So do you have things that you've noticed about your own writing or about... Is there any, I want to slow down here and stop and hear stuff, if there's anything that people want to say or ask or tell one another.
There is something else I'd like to share before we leave here. Is it our agenda?
Yeah, may as well.
This is that poem I didn't get to.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I've rewritten this and then gone right back to how I started.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Like I was getting too much in it.
You found your camp. It was on the piano, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I saw it there.
Yeah. I was taken downstairs, you know, they clean it, somebody just happened to say that it happens every now and then, you know, so I knew that. Then I asked where they do that, and I go down, so I get to see another part of it. Hold it.
It's where all the stuff goes. Yeah. Well, I saw that, and I thought, now, was that the one that Teak had on a couple of days ago?
Yeah.
And I couldn't convince myself yes or no. And
So I brought the answer with me. I call this home, and I wrote it up here. You ask me why I make my home in a mountain wood, and my answer does not come. The holly berries and the wild rose sweetens the air. The maple and the birch wave greetings in soft breezes. The water falls and streams its mesmerizing songs. The gentle deer mow my lawn, and with wind and snow prune my trees. Evergreens and mountains are my steeples. The squirrels chatter and visit my crumbs. Birds praise God with their music and are rewarded with flight. And I am at once at home and in awe. And I smile as I remember the question.
Okay. Responses?
Powerful.
Yeah.
Can you feel it?
No, yeah. I don't like the chipmunks, but I like them.
Yeah, I love them. I love them. I can't even understand why people, how people can't love them.
Yeah.
That's how much I love them. You know? I cannot imagine thinking of them as annoying.
I'm upset that you
do. Yeah.
Well, they will climb in your lap, and they will take your food right away from you. Yeah.
Yeah. And I rebel.
Yeah.
I almost want to put crumbs in my lap and break the rules on purpose just so they'll do it on my lap. You know?
Yep.
I want to go up and pet the bears. I mean, that's the kind of person I do. I have told people I want to do this. And I see
it would cure you.
Yeah.
I really don't know. I've had birds come right on my shoulder. I have petted marmots. I have had fish. I've fed fish and petted them on.
I think she's asking if you've ever had a bear park on your shoulder.
Yeah, well,
lots aren't as big.
Yeah, well, but, you know, I haven't had that kind of response from animals, even ones that can be violent. I just think they know if you're afraid.
Mm-hmm.
I do.
So do people.
Mm.
Yes, that's right. I mean, I was within 5 feet of a deer the other night. And if I'd been more patient, Joanne had to go back. I mean, if she hadn't had to go back, I'd have figured out a way to get closer. And I think I could have pet the deer. So I think that it's a perception. I really do.
I want to go back to a word that I heard in the poem, if you don't mind. Can you find the location of the place where it has the mesmerizing sound of the stream, something like that, in the poem that you just read?
The water falls and streams its mesmerizing songs.
Okay. Now I'll ask, how does that word work for you in that spot? Let's do the literal take first. What's happening, literally?
The water is streaming or falling.
Mm-hmm.
And my experience of it.
And the speaker is experiencing it as
mesmerizing.
Almost hypnotic.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Riveting.
Like
pretty soon that's the focus.
Like a mantra.
That kind of thing. Okay. I'm not picking on you or that word or anything like that. I'm using it as a sampler. When we hit a word like that in what is really a very straightforward narrative, and then we get to this interpretation of it.
An adjective, actually, right?
Pardon?
An adjective.
Yeah.
It's kind of not.
And so
there aren't other adjectives. This,
right.
It so sticks out.
So we get to this adjective way of behaving. We want to be very, very cautious that that's personal, that that's our adjective. Mm-hmm. Okay, if we're going to keep it. One way to draft things over and over again is throw out all the adjectives, see what you've got, and then make them earn their way back in. Mm-hmm. You'll end up with something quite stark in this gleaned out version, et cetera, et cetera. And then, if that adjective, just make a little rule for yourself and say, all right, here's my little pile of adjectives, this little list. And if one of them wants back in there, it's got a really, and maybe it's a synonym for one of those that needs to be in there or whatever. For me, at that juncture, and I'm just going to confess this to you, but I'm not going to, this is a confession, not a suggestion, T. If I ended up feeling that I wanted an adjective at that position, I would want it to earn its way back in by doing something like this. I would want it to have something of the sound of the water, or the asymmetricality of the sound of the rhythm, the rhythm, mm-hmm. or the sound of the if it's clicking rocks, I would want it to have syllables that had in them, or something. Mm-hmm. So I would want it to do the double duty of both describing and sounding like, so that it would have a musical quality about it. That's what I'm talking about when I mean. When I say the music of stuff, like the passage that I read you yesterday from a piece that had holding her high hymn halt, that has a musicality about it, and then also serves the purpose of being aspirin, and the reader is out of breath by the time they get there, so I as the poet don't have to say my daughter was out of breath, the reader can feel that rather than hear it, okay? So that's what I'm talking about when I say the adjectives would need to, earn their way back in. Yeah. They'd have to do double duty, triple duty, something in order to become back a part of it. But that's just that's one of the ways. Well, let me describe this to you for a second. In a particular poem of my own, there's a this poem is called Nest, and it has to do in it the speaker. Finds a little shape of shotgun shell casings in the snow under some pines. And originally, or early, sometime in the process, there were many, many, many things about that particular incident. That's kind of like a rifle, one thing, that's what a rifle shoots, is one piece of lead out there. But since it was shotgun shell casings, after many drafts and so on, I began to feel that rather than tell about one experience that the speaker had, let that be a little vignette, and then pull off and say other things about the speaker, so that it's more like shotgun shell casings actually operate. They spray out a lot of pellets. And so you would build a picture of the speaker and the speaker's sense of morality or sense of appropriateness or whatever, the opinions of the speaker in a way of getting a target pattern, of the bird's eye, the bird shot, rather than this one, hammering away at shell casings on the snow, in the snow, in a place that people were supposed to be safe from guns, yada, 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 yada. And I felt that by just saying other things about the speaker that would accomplish that. So that's what I mean when sort of the words aren't just their literal meaning or what we choose of their possible meanings, in that arrangement, but they also have to carry a duty to me in just as economy. An economy of words, where eventually we begin to be very, very skinflinty about turning loose of those words, And we say, all right, word, if you're in there, then you've got to be doing more than just having a meaning. You know, you have to have leaps of association, or you have to be sounding like the sound, or you have to be, you know, what, you know, onomatopoeia, or, you know, what else. So that's just kind of a suggestion for how to get to be a skinflint about our words, so that we don't give them out easily. And when that happens, I think we write out of a more genuine place, if I could say it that way.
I struggled with two things, and then I finally decided to just...
I wonder if there are the couple of things that I was wondering about. Go ahead.
The tensing of verbs and punctuation. And I don't know how to do it, so I just don't know if you write, you know, when you're doing your memory, is it always past tense? Do you vary?
What do you think about that? I have some thoughts about it, but you noticed it probably in the reading of that word. Didn't hurt your feelings or get you confused or anything. I think now it's possible for us in a piece. I know that in the eighth grade they had to stay in the tense we started in, you know. And I think with the development of the contemporary novel and the way in which, I mean, all writers have to buck against this, or at least accept it. I won't say buck against it, that sounds too maybe negative, but the fact that we've all seen movies, and movies affect writing now. No getting away from it, you know, unless you're virginal and have just been out in the timber and have never seen a film. Making a film, you know, and other similar video and so on does affect writing. And one of the methodologies of film now is to flip back and forth between the past and the present and the future and, you know, so on. And then there are many writers who are experimenting with that to see how appropriate and available that is for the writer to do that. Is it only something that filmmakers can get away with and have it understood by the audience and coherent and so on? And sometimes, frankly, they don't do it right. You know, we get way lost in this thing, you know. Where in the hell am I now, you know? Am I in the past, am I in the future, am I in this person's head, is this actually happening, so on. So I tend to want to trust, you know, when it gets to the point where I feel maybe it's time for an audience for the piece, I want to trust them. I want to trust the audience. I never want to condescend to anybody or anything. And I feel that, you know, a lot of yours swapping around between now and then and so on was had a natural feel about it, you know, where, here's how it felt, I want to say this, that it felt like the speaker was telling the story about what was going on, and that the speaker got caught up in it to the point where the speaker went back into that moment, you know, and we've got people stacking things, you know, in the present tense on the shelf and so on, and then the speaker would go back and tell us, you know, so and so and so on about a memory. Do you find this rhythm in the piece, or?
Yeah.
Yeah, see, so and so and so on about the memory, and pretty soon, boom, oh, I'm back in that time, you know. And I think that's actually, I don't know if you stumbled on it or it's just your natural way of laying things out, or...
Well, I thought it was all wrong, but I didn't know how to fix it.
Oh, I don't think it's wrong. No. What do you think is wrong?
No, I think that the nature of memory in the first place is very fluid and non-linear. Linear, right. And, I mean, I have memories of being really young where I can't... I don't remember anymore if it really happened or if it's a dream or a deja vu or a creation. And I think that's so cool, you know?
The cruelty of memory.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think I enjoy that experience for some reason.
Well, and there's this whole question to be asked. When I'm remembering something that's supposed to have happened when I was three, am I remembering it, or am I recalling elders telling the story in front of me, yeah, you know, et cetera?
Or seeing a picture.
Yeah, or seeing a photograph. That's right, a snapshot. Yeah.
That's what screwed up my memory.
That's
right. As I saw a picture of it later, it just...
Yeah. Well, I think they can all be part of the material, and I want to remind us again, and maybe it sounds like I'm saying this oftener than you care to hear about it or know what to do with it, but we start with a something that is perceived at the moment or remembered in time or whatever, but we do not have to be journalists about it, okay? That's the one of the early stages that we go through, is where we're reporting what happened, da 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 da, give me the facts, ma'am, please, that's all, just the facts, okay, close the door, you know, boom, my name is Friday. But we can go ahead then, and we are not sinning, I guess is what I want to say. We are not sinning to embroider, you know, if you know, say we get to a junction and we can't remember what color the cover was on the outboard motor. You know, it just isn't hitting us, you know. Remembering all this stuff, well, paint it. You know, what kind of words have we got? And what would sound good? And what would kind of look good? You've described the lake. It's really not blue. It's kind of a green color. What would look good? A magenta color, wine color, a turquoise color, you know. Paint the darn cover on the Evinrude so we can get on with the poem, you know. And will people forgive you for that? Well, if the rest of the poem is, or the essay or whatever it is, you know, is good. And it's really tough. I think poets have it kind of tough because when you're holding a piece of fiction, people know you made it up. Well, what's odd about that is a lot of it is based on truth,
right.
You know. Mm-hmm. But they think, well, you probably made all of it up, you know. Mm-hmm. But when you're holding up to someone a piece of poetry or a piece of essay material or something, that's why I call it creative nonfiction. It's not really fiction, but it's also not, you know, something that would stand up in a court of law, you know, because eventually we have to paint the cover of the Evinrude, you know. Or we have to say all the paint was scraped off or something, you know, or leave the motor out, you know. So that's a part of our decision making as the creator, is to embellish, torture, you know, fracture, fragment, you know, put the leg back on the spider, whatever needs to happen for the sake of the piece. After a time, the piece is beginning to live as an artifact itself. And for it to be the artifice and the finest that you can make it, you have to just go ahead and let it take on those kinds of attributes.
Yeah, that's interesting when you're talking about this, because the real dilemma for me, especially yesterday when you gave the assignment about be sensual, you know, descriptive, and I was remembering something and trying to describe it, and my kids would say this is exactly what you do in your house too, which is that every object contains a story.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like, you know, I was trying to describe something and stopping to tell stories.
Yeah.
And then feeling like, I'm not supposed to be doing that. Go back and describe things, you know.
I can't.
And so mine, which I would like to share, is kind of interwoven with these stories that led to a learning for me in the process. But it's hard to know if it took away from what would be quality in the writing to a third person.
Mm-hmm.
I have a very hard time knowing if I'm writing for myself or someone mm-hmm. else, and it has a dramatic effect on what comes out.
My best remark to that would be to say, continue holding on to it for yourself as long as you can. And if you do that, in other words, keep writing for yourself, writing for yourself, writing for yourself, thinking that no one else will read it, but that's what I mean, for as long as you can. And at some point, it's going to tell you that maybe somebody else will read it. And at that moment, you put on your editor's cap, you know, and you allow that kind of speaking in. But before that, you cover your ears to it. You know, will they get it? Oh, well, this is goofy, you know. Would somebody understand it when they read it? Well, it means that to me, but would anybody else get the way I've said it here? Try to hold off on all the audience of voices out there for as long as you can. And then at some point in me, and I've noticed in a lot of people that work with writing, it begins to turn the corner a little bit and peek around and say, you know, there is somebody around there that might be, you know, would enjoy hearing this or would gain from hearing it or seeing, reading it, whatever. And at that point, begin to listen a little. And let yourself be drawn around that corner a little more, you know, as you go along.
But this and see what
would you please? Yeah.
Because I don't know, it seems like it always gets too personal somehow. I remember the kitchen in the old house, a square with five doorways. The white stove stands freely by one door at some distance from the table. A long way to throw the liver after my parents left the room. But not so far it couldn't be found by nose easily a few days later. Two doors, one on either side of the table, one in the strange logic of old houses, conveniently the bathroom, the other the pantry. Both closed, held pungent mysteries to me at 4 and 5 and 6, onions and perfume, piss and ripe bananas. Another door led outside down the side of the house. The window next to it is where, one hot summer night, the peeping Tom watched my mom ironing, pretty in her white slip. I watched him watching, terrified. Rainbow trout, always needing cleaning, shiny in the sink. Next to the counter where the brown bag sat, in which I spied the jump rope that destroyed the Easter Bunny, Santa Claus, and the Tooth Fairy in one fell blow. I never knew so much innocence was lost in the old kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Ooh, that's wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Would you mind reading it again? Not because you didn't do a Jim Dandy job, but just, would you mind? Or if you'd care to, somebody else could, if you like.
They couldn't possibly.
Okay.
You talk about punctuation. I remember the kitchen in the old house, a square with 5 doorways. The white stove stands freely by one door at some distance from the table. A long way to throw the liver after my parents left the room, but not so far it couldn't be found by noise, by nose, easily a few days later. 2 doors, one on either side of the table, one in the strange logic of old houses, conveniently the bathroom, the other the pantry. Both closed, held pungent mysteries to me at 4 and 5 and 6. Onions and perfume, piss and ripe bananas. Another door led outside down the side of the house. The window next to it is where, one hot summer night, the peeping Tom watched my mom ironing, pretty in her white slip. I watched him watching, terrified. Rainbow trout, always needing cleaning, shiny in the sink. Next to the counter where the brown bag sat, in which I spied the jump rope that destroyed the Easter Bunny, Santa Claus, and the Tooth Fairy in one fell blow. I never knew so much innocence was lost in the old kitchen.
Remarks, I have several things that are occurring to me, and then I want to... Do you have to scoot?
Very visual. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thanks, Megan, for coming. So I have to go back to that other kind of work.
Yeah, laundry.
Oh, this is huge laundry day.
Yeah.
Okay. It's been great having you. Thanks for coming around.
Thank you very much.
I love the innocence part. Mm-hmm.
My question is, wasn't the piece so strong as it went along that final sentence, read the last sentence for me, I never knew
so much innocence was lost in the old kitchen.
Now, when do you think you knew that? Now, looking back?
I didn't know that till I wrote this
poem. You wrote the piece.
Because I was about to get to the next doorway,
mm-hmm.
you know, which went into the living room, mm-hmm. you know, where I fed nickel wafers to my brother, pretending mm-hmm. I was a priest. But
there are worse things to play.
But when I had the memory about
the peeping Tom.
No, about Santa Claus and things. That was when it was like I realized how many things happened in that kitchen, and we ran out of time. You said it was time anyway, so.
Right. Well, I want to mention that now we're kind of over time already by 10 minutes, and I want to be sure you get to lunch if you need to, but I have a couple of suggestions of just things that hit me while you were reading. That's a very, I think, wealthy piece. Mm-hmm. You know, it's got a lot of, it's, you know, I'm very happy for you that piece came as it has, and I don't know what your experiences have been with writing, but
if they haven't been all that happy until now, I would let myself be as happy as you're capable of, you know, and keep going. There's a thing that is officially called transferal in writing, and it's not the one that psychologists use or anything, but it's this one. It means that, say, for example, we've got this action of the liver being thrown, which is a, you know, wonderful, you know, little rebellious moment in the piece, but it's not gone so far that it can't be found by a nose a week later or something along those lines. I'm butchering it, I know, and I hate to paraphrase things, but suppose that she were to put something about the nose screaming out a week later. Well, see, that's another sense and another, you know, so that you're mixing two senses, and that's called transferal, so that you have one sense operating with the language of another sense, you know, where this nose is singing or is screaming or is yelping or is something for the attention. And I just wanted to mention that because, and then also, in the way in which I operate with as a listener to poems, what is the next to the last sentence? Where it's the holidays all go away in one
fell blow.
Okay, the word "blow" is a terrific word with which to end, you know, end a poem. I've never done it before, and I want to. I'd love to have the opportunity come up now, and maybe I'll nudge a few things that direction so I can end a poem with the word "blow." The bottom ends up being, for me, you know, a kind of caption, so that I've got a well-rendered picture here. You know, it's very naturalistic, and that it's realistic, and furthermore, it's naturalistic in a sort of John Updike way, and then somebody went into the gallery and put a caption under the painting. Mm-hmm. Now, how to get that thing said, which I think is important to say, that last sentence is somehow important to say, without simply, what happens is our trust in the reader, we mistrust the reader for one. It breaks down, we think, or we mistrust ourselves. We say, I couldn't possibly have rendered this picture in such a great, realistic, naturalistic way that they really will get it, so I'll tell them. You know. You know, if you didn't get it, boom, 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 hit you with the head. This is what I meant by that. You know, we editorialize, and you know, and so it can happen with a title change. It can, you know,
where the title
does a lot of work for you. Mm-hmm. You know, and I don't know. You know, I'm not going to suggest right now what that is. I would want to have it in front of me, and you know, so that might be one way to do it. It might be that it works its way into the body of the piece, so that it's not kind of dangling off the end like a caption. You know, very seldom do we go in. I mean, see, paintings do have titles, but they don't have captions. Mm-hmm. You know, pieces of sculpture have titles. They give us a hint. You know, we see a big, huge metal thing, and it's shaped all kinds of ways, and we go right up to it, and it has a little thing that says "Butterfly" by Alexander Calder. I mean, oh, that's what he's. You know. He's taken a little butterfly and made it huge, and it's moving around kind of like the wings fanning, and you know, and so the title helps us into it, and the poem proves the title rather than the poem exists for the caption. I didn't want to let you get away with that too easily. You can leave it that way, but I didn't want you to let it get you too easily. Well, we didn't actually write anything today, but I think we did get into the fix-up stage quite a lot, and this is kind of where I'd hope that the reading early would kind of take us into things. I'm very appreciative of your being here. I do want to ask if there are books out, if those could come back. Many of them are of highly sentimental value, or they were signed by the writer or whatever. And then does anybody have any closing remarks, because I don't like to make them.
Closing question. So you'll have to make the closing remark. It's up to you. Do you know of any books that would guide us the way you're guiding us now? I mean, we're about to leave. Are there books that help with this kind of?
Oh gosh. Well, when I used to teach so much, I used to try to. I went down once, and they had four or five textbooks for prep schoolers. Of different people that tried to teach, and it all sort of tried to bring a textbook in, and I ended up never really ever using one. You're hitting on some good stuff when you're doing the Bones book and those kinds of things. I think that those that suit me best are those that kind of approach it obliquely. Whatever the one is called, the artist, life as an artist, living in, what is that called, Joanne?
Artist way?
The artist life?
The artist way.
Yeah. Those kind of, where it's not really, because I kind of make up my own. I mean, I think there are a few good ones. There's one that a woman did about 5 years ago that I thought was pretty good, if you want just, you know, some set experiments to try. Mm-hmm. And her name, the last name begins with a B or a C. I think her first name is Jane. And the title isn't hitting me now, but when do you, you're not leaving?
Next bus stop.
Yeah. No, the next bus. Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. Udell, thanks for coming.
Thank you.
But I think that there are such books that could be helpful at this stage in your writing. But for me, it's really just interchanging. I would encourage you folks. You're already the beginnings of a writer's group. Mm-hmm. And I think writer's groups are a powerful tool for writing. And that's just a process of kind of drawing in a few people that will grow up to a certain size, and you say, okay, 9 is about it. You know, it's about what the living room holds, and about, you know, and then you have to make some rules, stuff like we meet in different, this is one of my favorite set of rules. We meet in different people's houses. You cannot clean up before we get there. Yeah, because this one came from a women writers group that I knew that lasted for over 20 years and is still going. And they made the rule that you couldn't clean up. Why? Because if you were cleaning, you weren't writing.
No.
You know, and none of them wanted to give up writing time to be cleaning. So this is not to impress anybody. You don't have to fix a casserole. If anybody wants, coffee, bring a thermos. If you want something else, stop by the liquor store. If you want, you know, whatever, fine. But we're not in this for entertaining and for impressing one another and so on. If you happen to get to my house and it's clean and tidy and I've got a nice bottle of wine, you know, how fortunate for you, but that's not the point of this. Yeah. So that it, boom, hit the house, and I had the rule, it lasts an hour and 45 minutes. That's all we've got time for. Some of us have kids, we've got dogs, we've got husbands to send out of town on planes, you know, and so it was just a very writerly group. And I really recommend that as a way, because they draw in things that they've been reading and things they've been writing and the kinds of things that we're doing here. And so it really does become a workshop, you know, in the fullest sense of the word. It's a funny, you know, pair of words, writing workshop. I mean, in the 19th century, writing belonged in the parlor, I guess, or in the university, or in the study, you know. But we're seeing ourselves more now as people in a studio or a workshop, a place where we're handling stuff, words and memory and all of that. I wish I could think for exact, Bradshaw, I think her name may be.
Jane Bradshaw.
I think that might be it. Okay, thanks for hanging around. I hope I haven't kept you from lunch.
Of classes next week, Monday and Tuesday mornings.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, we start handling that stuff out this afternoon and then go crazy with it throughout the evening. Oh, thank you. And congratulations.